Groovy, I said. Let's do it. A good illusion is all about imagination. You create a picture in your mind, imagining every detail, imagining so hard that the image in your head becomes nearly tangible, almost real. You have to be able to see it, hear it, touch it, taste it, smell it, to engage all your senses in its theoretical reality. If you can do that, if you can really believe in your fake version of reality, then you can pour energy into it and create it in the minds and senses of everyone looking at it. For the record, it's also how the best liars do business, by making their imagined versions of things so coherent that they almost believe it themselves. I'm not a terribly good liar, but I knew the basics of how to make an illusion work, and I had two secret weapons. The first was the tuft of hair from an actual Malk, which I could use to aid in the accuracy of my illusion. The second was a buddy of mine, a big gray tomcat named Mister, who deigned to share his apartment with Mouse and me. Mister didn't come with me on cases, being above such trivial matters, but he found me pleasant company when I was at home and not moving around too much, except when he didn't, in which case he went rambling. I closed my eyes once I'd drawn my chalk circle, gripped the Malk hair in my hand, and started my image on a model of Mister. I'd seen Malks a couple of times, and most of them bore the same kinds of battle scars Mister proudly wore. They didn't look exactly like cats, though. Their heads were shaped differently, and their fur was rougher and stiffer. The paws had one too many digits on them, too, and were wider than a cat's, but the motion as they moved was precisely the same. "Noctus ex illuminus," I murmured once the image was firmly fixed in my thoughts, that of three ugly, lean, battle-marked Malks walking through on their own calm business. I sent out the energy that would power the glamour and broke the circle with a slow, careful motion. "Is it working?" Gard asked quietly. "Yeah," I said, focused on the illusion, my eyes still closed. I fumbled about until I found Mouse's broad back, then rested one hand on his fur. "Stop distracting me. Walk." "Very well." She drew in a short breath, said something, and then there was a snapping sound and a flash of light. "The rune is active," she said. She put her hand on my shoulder. The Malks weren't using any light sources, and if a group of apparent Malks tried to walk through with one, it would kind of spoil the effect we were trying to achieve. So we'd have to make the walk in the dark.
"We have perhaps 5 minutes."
I grunted, touched my dog, and we all started walking, trusting Mouse to guide our steps. Even though it was dark, I didn't dare open my eyes. Any distraction from the image in my head would cause it to disintegrate like toilet paper in a hurricane. So I walked, concentrating, and hoped like hell it worked. I couldn't spare any brain time for counting, but we walked for what felt like half an hour, and I was getting set to ask Gard if we were through yet, when an inhuman voice, not a foot from my left ear, said, in plain English,
"More of these new claws arrive every day. We are hungry. We should shred the ape and have done."
I nearly fell on my ass. It startled me so much, but I held on to the image in my head. I'd heard Malk speak before, with their odd inflections and unsettling intonations, and the sound only reinforced the image in my head. A round of both supporting and disparaging comments rose from all around me, all in lazy, Malk-inflected English. There were more than 20 of them. There was a small horde.
"Patience," said another Malk.
The tone of voice somehow suggested this was a conversation that had repeated itself a million times.
"Let the ape think it has cowed us into acting as its door wardens. It hunts in the wizard's territory. The wizard will come to face it. The Earl King will give us great favor when we bring the wizard's head."
Gosh, I felt famous.
"I'm weary of waiting," said another Malk. "Let's kill the ape and its prey and then hunt the wizard down." "Patience, hunters. The wizard will come to us," the first one said. "The ape's turn will come after we have brought down the wizard."
There was an unmistakable note of pleasure in its voice.
"And his little dog, too."
Mouse made another subvocal rumble in his chest. I could, just barely, feel it in his back. He kept walking, though, and we passed through the stretch of tunnel occupied by the Malks. There was another endless stretch of minutes and several turns before Guard let out her breath between her teeth and said,
"There were more than 20."
"Yeah, I kinda noticed that."
"I think we are past them."
I sighed and released the image I'd been holding in my head, calling forth dim light from my amulet, or tried to release the image, at any rate. I opened my eyes and blinked several times, but my head was like one of those TVs at the department store, when one image has been burned into it for too long. I looked at Mouse and Guard, and had trouble shaking the picture of the savage, squash-headed Malks I'd been imagining around them with such intensity.
"Do you have another one of those rune things?" I asked her.
"No," Guard said. "We'll have to get creative on the way out," I said.
"There's no need to worry about that yet," she said, and started walking forward again.
"Sure there is. Once we get the girl, we have to get back with her. Christ, haven't you read any Joseph Campbell at all?" She shrugged one shoulder.
"Grendelkin are difficult opponents. Either we'll die or it will. So there's only a 50-50 chance that we'll need to worry about the Malks on the way out. Why waste the effort until we know it will be necessary?"
"Call me crazy, but I find that if I plan for the big things, like how to get back to the surface, it makes it a little simpler to manage the little things, like how to keep on breathing." She held up a hand and said,
"Wait."
I stopped in my tracks, listening. Mouse came to a halt, snuffling at the air, his ears twitching around like little radar dishes, but he gave no sign that he'd detected lurking danger.
"We're close to its lair," she murmured.
I arched an eyebrow. The tunnel looked exactly the same as it had for several moments now. "How do you know?"
"I can feel it," she said.
"You can do that?" She started forward.
"Yes. It's how I knew it was moving in the city to begin with." I ground my teeth.
"It might be nice if you considered sharing that kind of information."
"It isn't far," she said. "We might be in time. Come on."
I felt my eyebrows go up. Mouse had us both beat when it came to purely physical, sensory input, and he'd given no indication of a hostile presence ahead. My own senses were attuned to all kinds of supernatural energies, and I'd kept them focused ever since we'd entered Undertown. I hadn't sensed any stirring of any kind that would indicate some kind of malevolent presence. If knowledge is power, then it follows that ignorance is weakness. In my line of work, ignorance can get you killed. Guard hadn't said anything about any kind of mystic connection between herself and this beastie, but it was the most likely explanation for how she could sense its presence when I couldn't. The problem with that was that those kinds of connections generally didn't flow one way. If she could sense the Grendelkin, odds were the Grendelkin could sense her right back.
"Whoa, wait," I said. "If this thing might know we're coming, we don't want to go rushing in blind."
"There's no time. It's almost ready to breed."
There was a hint of a snarl in her words as the axe came down off her shoulder. Guard pulled what looked like a road flare out of her duffel bag and tossed the bag aside. Then she threw back her head and let out a scream of pure, unholy defiance. The sound was so loud, so raw, so primal, it hardly seemed human. It wasn't a word, but that didn't stop her howl from eloquently declaring Guard's rage, her utter contempt for danger, for life, and for death. That battle cry scared the living snot out of me, and it wasn't even aimed in my direction. Guard struck the flare to life with a flick of a wrist and shot me a glance over her shoulder. Eerie green light played up over her face, casting bizarre shadows, and her icy eyes were very wide and white-rimmed above a smile stretched so tightly that the blood had drained from her lips. Her voice quavered disconcertingly.
"Enough talk."
Holy Schwarzenegger. Guard had lost it. This wasn't the reaction of the cool, reasoning professional I'd seen working for Marcone. I'd never actually seen anyone go truly old-school berserker gang, but that scream, it was like hearing an echo rolling down through the centuries from an ancient world, a more savage world, now lost to the mists of time. And suddenly I had no trouble at all believing her age.
She charged forward, whipping her axe lightly around with her right hand, holding the blazing star of the flare in her left. Guard let out another banshee shriek as she went, a wordless cry of challenge to the Grendelkin that declared her intent as clearly as any horde of phonemes. I am coming to kill you. And ahead of us, in the tunnels, something much, much bigger than Guard answered her. A deep-chested basso bellow that shook the walls of the tunnel in answer. Bring it on! My knees turned shaky. Hell, even Mouse stood with his ears pressed against his skull, tail held low, body set in a slight crouch. I doubt I looked any more courageous than he did, but I kicked my brain into gear, spat out a nervous curse, and hurried after her. Charging in headlong might be a really stupid idea, but it would be an even worse idea to stand around doing nothing, throwing away the only help I was likely to get. Besides, for better or worse, I'd agreed to work with Guard, and I wasn't going to let her go in without covering her back. So I charged headlong down the tunnel toward the source of the terrifying bellow. Mouse, perhaps wiser than I, hesitated a few seconds longer, then made up for it on the way down the tunnel until he was running a pace in front of me, matching my stride. We'd gone maybe 20 yards before his breath began to rumble out in a growl of pure hostility, and he let out his own roar of challenge. Hey, when in Samaria, do as the Samarians do. I screamed, too. It got lost in all the echoes bouncing around the tunnels. Guard, running hard 10 paces ahead of me, burst into a chamber. She gathered herself in a sudden leap, flipping neatly in the air and plummeted from sight. The falling green light of the flare showed me that the tunnel opened into the top of a chamber the size of a small hotel atrium. And if Mouse hadn't stopped first and leaned back against me, I might have slid over the edge before I could stop. As it was, I got a really good look at a drop of at least 30 feet to a wet stone floor. Guard landed on her feet, turned the momentum into a forward roll, and a shaggy blur the size of an industrial freezer whipped past her, slamming into the wall with a coughing roar and a shudder of impact. The blonde woman bounced up, kicked off a stone wall, flipped over again, and came down on her feet, axe held high. She'd discarded the flare, leaving it in the center of the floor, and I got my first good look at the place, and at the things in it. First of all, the chamber, cavern, whatever it was huge. 30 feet from ceiling to floor, at least 30 feet wide, and it stretched out into the darkness beyond the sharp light cast by the flare. Most of it was natural stone. Some of the surfaces showed signs of being crudely cut with hand-wielded tools. A ledge about 2 feet wide ran along the edge of the chamber in a C-shape up near the top. I'd nearly tumbled off the ledge into the cavern. There were stairs cut into the wall below me, if you could call the 12-inch projections crudely hacked out of the stone every couple of feet a stairway. My glance swept over the cavern below. A huge pile of newspapers, old blankets, blood-stained clothes, and unidentifiable bits of fabric must have served as a nest or a bed for the creature. It was 3 feet high in the middle and a good 10 or 12 feet across. A mound of bones nearby was very nearly as large. The old ivory gleamed in the eerie light of the flare, cleared entirely of meat, though the mound was infested with rats and vermin. All tiny moving forms and glittering red eyes. A huge stone had been placed in the center of the floor. A metal beer keg sat on top of it, between the tied-down, spread-eagle legs of a rather attractive and very naked young woman. She'd been tied down with rough ropes, directly over a thick layer of old bloodstains, congealed into an almost rubbery coating on the rock. Her eyes were wide, her face flushed with tears. And she was screaming. Guard whipped her axe through a series of scything arcs in front of her, driving them at the big furry blur. I had no idea how she was covering the ground fast enough to keep up with the thing. They were both moving at kung fu theater speed. One of Guard's swipes must have tagged it because there was a sudden bellow of rage, and it bounded into the shadows outside the light of the flare. She let out a howl of frustration. The head of her axe was smeared with black fluid, and as it ran across the steel, flickers of silver fire appeared in the shape of more strange runes. "Wizard!" she bellowed. "Give me light!" I was already on it, holding my amulet high and behind my head, ramming more will through the device. The dim wizard light flared into incandescence, throwing strong light at least 100 feet down the long gallery, and drawing a shriek of pain and surprise from the Grendelkin. I saw it for maybe 2 seconds, while it crouched with one arm thrown up to shield its eyes. The Grendelkin was flabby, over a quarter ton of muscle, and the nails on its fingers and toes were black, long, and dangerous-looking. It was big, 9 or 10 feet, and covered in hair. It wasn't fur, like a bear or a dog, but hair, human hair, with pale skin easily seen beneath, so that the impression it gave was one of an exceptionally hirsute man rather than that of a beast. And the beast was definitely male, terrifyingly so. I'd seen smaller fire extinguishers. And from the look of things, Guard and I must have interrupted him in the middle of foreplay. No wonder he was pissed. Guard saw the Grendelkin and charged forward. I saw my chance to pitch in. I lifted my staff and pointed it at the creature, gathering another surge of will, and snarled, "Fuego!" My staff was an important tool, allowing me to focus and direct energy much more precisely and with more concentration than I could manage without it. It didn't work as well as my more specialized blasting rod for directing fire, but for this purpose it would do just fine. A column of golden flame as wide as a whiskey barrel leapt across the cavern to the Grendelkin, smashing into his head and upper body. It was too dispersed to kill the Grendelkin outright, but hopefully it would blind and distract the beast enough to let Guard get in the killing blow. The Grendelkin lowered his arm, and I saw a quick flash of yellow eyes, a hideous face, and a mouthful of fangs. Those teeth spread into a smile, and I realized I might as well have hit him with a stream of water from a garden hose for all the effect the fire had on him. He moved, an abrupt whipping of his massive shoulders, and flung a stone at me. Take it from me, the Grendelkin's talents were wasted on the abduct, rape, devour industry. He should have been playing professional ball. By the time I realized the rock was on the way, it had already hit me. There was a popping sound from my left shoulder and a wave of agony. Something flung me to the ground, driving the breath out of my lungs. My amulet fell from my suddenly unresponsive fingers, and the brilliant light died at once. Damn it! I had assumed big and hostile meant dumb, and the Grendelkin wasn't. The beast had deliberately waited for Guard to charge forward, out of the light of the dropped flare, before he threw.
"Wizard!"
Guard bellowed. I couldn't see anything. The brief moment of brilliant illumination had blinded my eyes to the dimmer light of the flare, and Guard couldn't be in much better shape. I got to my feet, trying not to scream at the pain in my shoulder, and staggered back to look down at the room. The Grendelkin bellowed again, and Guard screamed, this time in pain. There was the sound of a heavy blow, and Guard, her hands empty, flew across the circle of green flare light, a dim shadow. She struck the wall beneath me with an ugly, heavy sound. It was all happening so fast. Hell's bells, but I was playing out of my league here. I turned to Mouse and snarled an instruction. My dog stared at me for a second, ears flattened to his skull, and didn't move.
"Go!" I screamed at him. "Go! Go! Go!"
Mouse spun and shot off back down the way we'd come. Guard groaned on the floor beneath me, stirring weakly at the edge of the dim circle of light cast by the flare. I couldn't tell how badly she was hurt, but I knew that if I didn't move before the Grendelkin finished her, she wasn't going to get any better. I could hear Elizabeth sobbing in despair.
"Get up, Harry," I growled at myself. "Get a move on."
I could barely move my left arm, so I gripped my staff with my right and began negotiating the precarious stone stairway. A voice laughed out in the darkness. It was a deep voice, masculine, mellow, and smooth. When it spoke, it did so with precise, cultured pronunciation.
"Geet bitch," the Grendelkin murmured. "That's the most fun I've had in a century. Soot, but I wish there were a few more choosers running about the world. You're a dying breed."
I could barely see the damned stairs and the flare's light. My foot slipped and I nearly fell.
"Who's the cider madder?" the Grendelkin asked.
Gesundheit, I said. The beast appeared at the far side of the circle of light, and I stopped in my tracks. The Grendelkin's yellow eyes gleamed with malice and hunger. He flexed his claw-tipped hands very slowly, baring his teeth in another smile. My mouth felt utterly dry and my legs were shaking. I'd seen him move. If he rushed me, things could get ugly. Strike that. When he rushed me, things were going to get ugly. "Is that a fire extinguisher in your pocket?" I asked, studying the Grendelkin intently. "Or are you just happy to see me?" The Grendelkin's smile spread wider. "Most definitely the latter. I'm going to have two mouths to feed shortly. What did she promise you to fool you into coming with her?" "You got it backward. I permitted her to tag along with me," I said. The Grendelkin let out a low, lazily wicked laugh. It was eerie as hell hearing such a refined voice come from a package like that. "Do you think you're a threat to me, little man?" "You think I'm not?" Idly, the Grendelkin dragged the clawed fingers of one hand around on the stone floor beside him. Little sparks jumped up here and there. "I've been countering Side since before I left the old world. Without that, you're nothing more than a monkey with a stick." He paused and added, "A rather weak and clumsy monkey at that." "Big guy like you shouldn't have any trouble with little old me, then," I said. His eyes were strange. I'd never seen any quite like that. His face, though pretty ugly, was similar to others I'd seen. "I guess you have some history with Miss Guard there."
"Family feuds are always the worst," the Grendelkin said.
"Have to take your word for it," I said. "Just like I'm going to have to take these women. I'd rather do it peaceably than the hard way. Your call. Walk away, big guy. We'll both be happier."
The Grendelkin looked at me and then threw his head back in a rich, deeply amused laugh.
"It's not enough that I already have a brood mare and a wounded little wildcat to play with. I also have a clown. It's practically a festival."
And with that, the Grendelkin rushed me. A crushing fist the size of a volleyball flicked at my face. I was fast enough, barely, to slip the blow. I flung myself to the cavern floor, gasping as the shock of landing reached my shoulder. That sledgehammer of flesh and bone slammed into the wall with a brittle crunching sound. Chips of flying stone stung my cheek. It scared the crap out of me, which was just as well. Terror makes a great fuel for some kinds of magic, and the get-the-hell-away-from-me blast of raw force I unleashed on the Grendelkin would have flung a parked car to the other side of the street and into the building beyond. The Grendelkin hadn't been kidding about knowing counter-magic, though. All that naked force hit him and just sort of slid off him, like water pouring around a stone. It only drove him back about 2 steps, which was room enough to let me drop to 1 knee and swing my staff again. It wasn't a bone-crushing blow, powered as it was by only 1 hand and from a fairly unbalanced position, but I got him in the fire extinguisher. The Grendelkin let out a howl about 2 octaves higher than his original bellows had been, and I scooted around him, running for the altar stone where Elizabeth Braddock lay helpless, away from guard. I wanted the Grendelkin to focus all his attention on me. He did.
"Behind you!"
Elizabeth screamed, her eyes wide with terror. I whirled, and a sweep of the Grendelkin's arm ripped the staff out of my hand. Something like a steel vise clamped around my neck, and my feet came up off the ground. The Grendelkin lifted my face to his level. His breath smelled of blood and rotten meat. His eyes were bright with their fury. I kicked at him, but he held me out of reach of anything vital, and my kicks plunked uselessly into his belly and ribs.
"I was going to make it quick for you," he snarled, "for amusing me, but I'm going to start with your arms."
If I didn't have him right where I wanted him, I'd have been less than sanguine about my chances of survival. I'd accomplished that much, at least. He had his back to the tunnel.
"Rip them off one at a time, little cider-mutter."
He paused.
"Which, when viewed from a literary perspective, has a certain amount of irony."
He showed me more teeth.
"I'll let you watch me eat your hands, let you see what I do to these bitches before I'm done with you."
Boy, was he going to get it.
One of his hands grabbed my left arm, and the pain of my dislocated shoulder made my world go white. I fought through the agony, ripped Elizabeth Braddock's pointy-handled hairbrush from my duster's pocket, and drove it like an ice pick into the Grendelkin's forearm. He roared and flung me into the nearest wall, which hurt. Lots. I fell to the stone floor of the cavern in a heap. After that, my vision shrank to a tunnel and began to darken. This was just as well. Fewer distractions that way. Now all I had to do was time it right. A sound groaned down from the tunnel entrance above. An odd, ululating murmur echoed into unintelligibility. The furious Grendelkin ripped the brush out of his arm and flung it away, but when he heard the sound, he turned his ugly kisser back toward the source. I focused harder on the spell I had coming than upon anything I'd ever done. I had no circle to help me, lots of distractions, and absolutely no room to screw it up. The strange sound resolved itself into a yowling chorus, like half a hundred bandsaws on helium, and Mouse burst out of the tunnel with a living thunderstorm of Malks in hot pursuit. My dog flung himself into the empty air, and Malks bounded after him, determined not to let him escape. Mouse fell 30 feet onto the huge pile of nesting material, landing with a yelp. The Malks spilled after him, yowling in fury, dozens and dozens of malevolent eyes glittering in the light of the flare. Some jumped, some flowed seamlessly down the rough stairs, and others bounded forward, sank their claws into the stone of the far wall, and slid down it like a fireman down a pole. I unleashed the spell.
"Useless vermin!"
bellowed the Grendelkin, his voice still pitched higher than before. He pointed at me, a battered-looking man in a long leather coat, and roared,
"Kill the wizard, or I'll eat every last one of you!"
The Malks, now driven as much by fear as anger, immediately swarmed all over me. I gave them a pretty good time of it, but there were probably better than 36 of them, and the leather coat couldn't cover everything. Claws and fangs flashed. Blood spattered. The Malks went insane with bloodlust. I screamed, swinging wildly with both hands, killing a Malk here or there, but unable to protect myself from all those claws and teeth. The Grendelkin turned toward the helpless Elizabeth. It was a real bitch trying to undo the Grendelkin's knotted ropes while still holding the illusion in place in my mind. Beneath the glamour that made him look like me, he fought furiously, clawing and swinging at the Malks attacking him. It didn't help that Elizabeth was screaming again, thanks to the illusion of the Grendelkin I was holding over myself, but hey, no plan is perfect.
"Mouse!"
I cried. A Malk flew over my head, screaming, and splattered against a wall. My dog bounded up just as I got the girl loose. I shoved her at him and said,
"Get her out of here! Run! Go! Go! Go!"
Elizabeth didn't know what the hell was going on, but she understood that last part well enough. She fled back toward the crude staircase. Mouse ran beside her, and when a Malk flung itself at Elizabeth's naked back, my dog intercepted the little monster in the air, catching it as neatly as a frisbee at the park. Mouse snarled and shook his jaws once. The Malk's neck broke with an audible snap. My dog dropped it and fled on. I grabbed my staff and ran to guard. The Malks hadn't noticed her yet. They were still busy mobbing the Grendelkin. Crap. My concentration had wavered. It looked like itself again, as did I. I whirled and focused my will upon the giant pile of clean-picked bones. I extended my staff and snarled,
"Counterspell this! Forzari!"
Hundreds of pounds of sharp white bone flung themselves at the Grendelkin and the Malks alike. I threw the bones hard, harder than the Grendelkin had thrown his rock, and the bone shards ripped into them like the blast of an enormous shotgun. Without waiting to see the results, I snatched up the still-burning flare and flung it into the pile of nesting fabric, bloody clothes, and old newspapers. The whole mound flared instantly into angry light and smothering smoke.
"Get up!"
I screamed at guard. One side of her face was bruised and swollen, and she had a visibly broken arm, one of the bones in her forearm protruding from the skin. With my help, she staggered up, dazed and choking on the smoke, which also blotted out the light. I got her onto the stairs, and even in our battered state, we set some kind of speed record going up them. The deafening chorus of bellowing Grendelkin and howling Malks faded a little as the smoke started choking them, too. Air was moving in the tunnel as the fire drew on it just as it might a chimney. I lit up my amulet again to show us the way out.
"Wait!"
Guard gasped, 50 feet up the tunnel.
"Wait!"
She fumbled at her jacket pocket, where she kept the little ivory box, but she couldn't reach it with her sound arm. I dug it out for her.
"Triangle. 3 lines over it,"
she said, leaning against a wall for support.
"Get it out."
I poked through the little ivory scrabble tiles until I found one that matched her description. "This one?" I demanded.
"Careful,"
she growled.
"It's a Sunder rune."
She grabbed it from me, took a couple of steps back toward the Grendelkin's cavern, murmured under her breath, and snapped the little tile. There was a flicker of deep red light, and the tunnel itself quivered and groaned.
"Run!"
We did. Behind us, the tunnel collapsed in on itself with a roar, sealing the Malks and the Grendelkin away beneath us, trapping them in the smothering smoke. We both stopped for a moment after that, as dust billowed up the tunnel and the sound of furious supernatural beings cut off as if someone had flipped a switch. The silence was deafening. We both stood there, panting and wounded. Guard sank to the floor to rest.
"You were right," I said. "I guess we didn't need to worry about the Malks on the way out."
Guard gave me a weary smile.
"That was my favorite axe."
"Go back for it," I suggested. "I'll wait for you here." She snorted. Mouse came shambling up out of the tunnel above us. Elizabeth Braddock clung to his collar and looked acutely embarrassed about her lack of clothing.
What?
She whispered.
What happened here? I don't understand.
"It's all right, Mrs. Braddock," I said. "You're safe. We're going to take you back to your husband." She closed her eyes, shuddered, and started to cry. She sank down to put her arms around Mouse's furry ruff and buried her face in his fur. She was shivering with the cold. I shucked out of my coat and draped it around her. Guard eyed her, then her own broken arm, and let out a sigh.
"I need a drink."
I spat some grit out of my mouth. "Ditto. Come on." I offered her a hand up. She took it. Several hours and doctors later, Guard and I wound up back at the pub, where the beer festival was winding to a conclusion. We sat at a table with Mac. The Braddocks had stammered a gratuitous number of thanks and rushed off together. Mac's keg had a blue ribbon taped to it. He'd drawn all of us a mug.
"Night of the Living Brews," I said.
I had painkillers for my shoulder, but I was waiting until I was home and in bed to take one. As a result, I ached pretty much everywhere.
"More like Night of the Living Brews."
Mac rose, drained his mug, and held it up in a salute to Guard and me.
"Thanks."
"No problem," I said. Guard smiled slightly and bowed her head to him. Mac departed. Guard finished her own mug and examined the cast on her arm.
"Close one."
"Little bit," I said.
"Can I ask you something?"
She nodded.
"The Grendelkin called you a geet," I said.
"Yes, he did."
"I'm familiar with only one person referred to in that way," I said.
"There are a few more around," Guard said, "but everyone's heard of that one."
"You call the Grendelkin a scion of Grendel," I said. "Am I to take it that you're a scion of the geet?" Guard smiled slightly.
"My family and the Grendelkins have a long history."
"He called you a chooser," I said. She shrugged again and kept her enigmatic smile. "Guard isn't your real name," I said, "is it?"
"Of course not," she replied.
I sipped some more of Mac's award-winning dark.
"You're a Valkyrie, a real one."
Her expression was unreadable.
"I thought Valkyries mostly did pickups and deliveries," I said,
"choosing the best warriors from among the slain, taking them off to Valhalla. Oh, and serving drinks there. Odin's virgin daughters pouring mead for the warriors, parting until Ragnarok." Guard threw her head back and laughed.
"Virgin daughters?"
She rose, shaking her head, and glanced at her broken arm again. Then she leaned down and kissed me on the mouth. Her lips were a sweet, hungry little fire of sensation, and I felt the kiss all the way to my toes, some places more than others. She drew away slowly, her pale blue eyes shining. Then she winked at me and said, "Don't believe everything you read, Dresden." She turned to go, then paused to glance over her shoulder. "Though, to be honest, sometimes he does like us to call him Daddy. I'm Sigrun." I watched Sigrun go, then I finished the last of the beer. Mouse rose expectantly, his tail wagging, and we set off for home.
Day Off, from Blood Light, edited by Kevin J. Anderson. Takes place between Small Favor and Turncoat. Kevin Anderson talked to me at NYCC and asked me if I'd be interested in participating in a new kind of anthology, for me anyway, in which authors known for their work in supernatural and horror fiction try their hands at comedy. I loved the idea. Poor Dresden. I mean, I keep putting the weight of the world on the poor guy's shoulders, and I feel really bad about it. No, really, I'm serious. I feel awful, honestly. Okay, well, less awful and more gleeful, but you get the point. It's easy to torture Harry when there are master vampires and super ghouls and ghosts and demons and ogres traipsing all over the scenery. But I found myself intrigued with the idea of making him suffer just as much frustration and embarrassment in a situation where his opponents and problems were relatively trivial. I don't really know how other people reacted to poor Harry struggling to get to enjoy a day off work, but I thought it was pretty darn funny. The thief was examining another trap doorway when I heard something, the tromp of approaching feet. The holy woman was in the middle of another sermon about attentiveness or something, but I held up my hand for silence and she obliged. We could hear 20 sets of feet, maybe more. I let out a low growl and reached for my sword. "Company." "Easy, my son," the holy woman said. "We don't even know who it is yet." The ruined mausoleum was far enough off the beaten path to make it unlikely that anyone had just wandered in on us. The holy woman was dreaming if she thought the company might be friendly. A moment later they appeared, the local magistrate and 2 dozen of his thugs. "Always with the corrupt government officials," muttered the wizard from behind me. I glanced back at him and then looked for the thief. The nimble little minx was nowhere to be seen. "You are trespassing," boomed the magistrate. He had a big, boomy voice. "Leave this place immediately on pain of punishment by the Crown's law."
"Sir," replied the holy woman, "our mission here is of paramount importance. The writ we bear from your own liege requires you to render aid and assistance in this matter."
"But not to violate the graves of my subjects," he boomed some more. "Begone! Before I unleash the 9 fires of Atarak upon—" "Enough talk," I growled, and threw my heavy dagger at his chest. Propelled by my massive thews, the dagger hit him 2 inches below his left nipple, a perfect heart shot. It struck with enough force to hurl him from his feet. His men howled with surprised fury. I drew the huge sword from my back, let out a leonine roar, and charged the 2 dozen thugs.
"Enough talk!"
I bellowed and whipped the 20-pound greatsword at the nearest target as if it were a wooden yardstick. He went down in a heap.
"Enough talk!"
I howled and kept swinging. I smashed through the next several thugs as if they were made of soft wax. Off to my left, the thief came out of nowhere and neatly sliced the Achilles tendons of another thug. The holy woman took a ready stance with her quarterstaff and chanted out a prayer to her deities at the top of her lungs. The wizard shrieked, and a fireball whipped over my head, exploding 21 feet in front of me, then spread out in a perfect circle, like the shockwave of a nuke, burning and roasting thugs as it went, and stopping a bare 12 inches shy of my nose.
"Oh, come on," I said. "It doesn't work like that."
"What?" demanded the wizard.
"It doesn't work like that," I insisted. "Even if you call up fire with magic, it's still fire. It acts like fire. It expands in a sphere, and under a ceiling, that means it goes rushing much farther down hallways and tunnels. It doesn't just go 20 feet and then stop." Fireballs used to work like that, the wizard sighed. But do you know what a chore it is to calculate exactly how far those things will spread? I mean, it slows everything down.
It's simple math, I said, and it's way better than the fire just spreading 20 feet, regardless of what's around it.
What, do fireballs carry tape measures or something?
Billy the werewolf sighed and put down his character sheet and his dice.
Harry, he protested gently, repeat after me, it's only a game.
I folded my arms and frowned at him across his dining room table. It was littered with snacks, empty cans of pop, pieces of paper, and tiny model monsters and adventurers, including a massively thewed barbarian model for my character. Georgia, Billy's willowy brunette wife, sat at the table with us, as did the red-headed bombshell Andy, while lanky Kirby lurked behind several folding screens covered with fantasy art at the head of the table.
I'm just saying, I said, there's no reason that magic can't be portrayed at least a little more accurately, is there?
Again with this discussion, Andy sighed. I mean, I know he's the actual wizard and all, but Christ.
Kirby nodded glumly.
It's like taking a physicist to a Star Trek movie.
Harry, Georgia said firmly, you're doing it again.
Oh, no, I'm not, I protested. All I'm saying is that...
Georgia arched an eyebrow and gave me a steady look down her aquiline nose.
You know the law, Dresden.
He who kills the cheer springs for beer, chanted the rest of the table.
Oh, bite me, I muttered at them,
but a grin was diluting my scowl as I dug out my wallet and tossed a 20 on the table. Okay, Kirby said. Roll your fireball damage, Will. Billy slung out a double handful of square dice and said,
Ha! 1.2 over median. Suck on that, henchman.
They're all dead, Kirby confirmed. We might as well break there until next week.
Crap, I said. I barely got to hit anybody.
I only got to hit one, Andy said.
Georgia shook her head. I didn't even get to finish casting my spell.
Oh, yes, Billy gloated. 7 modules of identifying magic items and repairing things the stupid barbarian broke, but I finally come into my own. Was it like that for you, Harry?
Let you know when I come into my own, I said, rising. But my hopes are high. Why, this very morrow, I, Harry Dresden, have a day off.
The devil you say, Billy exclaimed, grinning at me as the group began cleaning up from the evening's gaming session. I shrugged into my black leather duster. No apprentice, no work, no errands for the council, no warden stuff, no trips out of town for paranet business. My very own free time.
Georgia gave me a wide smile.
Tell me you aren't going to spend it puttering around that musty hole in the ground you call a lab.
I said.
Look, Andy said. He's blushing.
I am not blushing, I said.
I swept up the empty bottles and pizza boxes and headed into Billy and George's little kitchen to dump them into the trash.
Georgia followed me in, reaching around me to send several pieces of paper into the trash, too.
Hot date with Stacy? She asked, her voice pitched to keep the conversation private.
I think if I ever called her Stacy, Anastasia might beat the snot out of me for being too lazy to speak her entire name, I replied.
You seem a little tense about it.
I shrugged a shoulder. This is going to be the first time we spend a whole day together without something trying to rip us to pieces along the way. I want it to go right, you know? I pushed my fingers back through my hair. I mean, both of us could use a day off.
Sure, sure,
Georgia said, watching me with calm, knowing eyes. Do you think it's going to go anywhere with her?
I shrugged. Don't know. She and I have very different ideas about, well, basically everything except what to do with things that go around hurting people.
The tall, willowy Georgia glanced back toward the dining room, where her short, heavily muscled husband was putting away models.
Opposites attract. There's a song about it and everything.
One thing at a time, I said. Neither one of us is trying to inspire the poets for the ages. We like each other. We make each other laugh. God, that's nice these days.
I sighed and glanced up at Georgia a little sheepishly.
I just want to show her a nice time tomorrow.
Georgia had a gentle smile on her narrow, intelligent face.
I think that's a very healthy attitude.
I was just getting into my car, a battered old Volkswagen Bug I've dubbed the Blue Beetle, when Andy came hurrying over to me. There'd been a dozen alphas when I'd first met them, college kids who had banded together and learned just enough magic to turn themselves into wolves. They'd spent their time as werewolves protecting and defending the town,
which needed all the help it could get. The conclusion of their college educations had seen most of them move on in life, but Andy was one of the few who had stuck around. Most of the Alphas adopted clothing that was easily discarded, the better to swiftly change into a large wolf without getting tangled up in jeans and underwear. On this particular summer evening, Andy was wearing a flirty little purple sundress and nothing else. Between her hair, her build, and her long, strong legs, Andy's picture belonged on the nose of a World War II bomber, and her hurried pace was intriguingly kinetic. She noticed me noticing, and gave me a wicked little smile and an extra jiggle the last few steps. She was the sort to appreciate being appreciated. "Harry," she said, "I know you hate to mix business with pleasure, but there's something I was hoping to talk to you about tomorrow." "Sure, sweetheart," I said in my best bogey dialect. "Not tomorrow, day off. Important things to do."
"I know," Andy said, "but I was hoping..."
"If it waited until after the Arcanos game, it can wait until after my day off," I said firmly. Andy almost flinched at the tone and nodded.
"Okay."
I felt myself arch an eyebrow. I hadn't put that much harsh into it, and Andy wasn't exactly the sort to be fazed by verbal salvos, regardless of their nature or volume. Socially speaking, the woman was armored like a battleship. "Okay," I replied. "I'll call." Kirby approached her as I got into the car, put an arm around her from behind, and tugged her backside against his front side, leaning down to sniff at her hair. She closed her eyes and pressed herself into him. "Yeah." I let myself feel a little smug as I pulled out of the lot and drove home. That one had just been a matter of time, despite everything Georgia had said. I totally called it. I pulled into the gravel parking lot beside the boarding house where I live and knew right away I had a problem. Perhaps it was my keenly developed intuition, honed by years of investigative work as the infamous Harry Dresden, Chicago's only professional wizard, Seamus of the supernatural, gumshoe of the ghostly, wise guy of the weird, warning me with preternatural awareness of the shadow of death passing nearby. Or maybe it was the giant black van painted with flaming skulls, goat's head pentacles, and inverted crosses that was parked in front of my apartment door. 666 of one, half a dozen of another. The van's doors opened as I pulled in, and people in black spilled out with neither the precision of a professional team of hitters nor the calm swagger of competent thugs. They looked like I'd caught them in the middle of eating sack lunches. One of them had what looked like taco sauce spilled down the front of his frothy white lace shirt. The other four, well, they looked like something. They were all wearing mostly black and mostly goth wear, which meant a lot of velvet with a little leather, rubber, and PVC to spice things up. Three women, two men, all of them fairly young. All of them carried wands and staves and crystals dangling from chains, and all of them had deadly serious expressions on their faces. I parked the car, never looking directly at them, and then got out of it, stuck my hands in my duster pockets, and stood there waiting.
"You're Harry Dresden," said the tallest one there, a young man with long black hair and a matching goatee.
I squinted at nothing like Clint Eastwood would do, and said nothing like Chow Yun Fat would do.
"You're the one who came to Nolan's last week."
He said it Nolan's, even though the rest of his accent was Midwest standard.
"You're the one who desecrated my works."
I blinked at him. "Whoa, wait a minute. There actually was a curse on that nice lady?" He sneered at me.
"She had earned my wrath."
"How about that?" I said. "I figured it for some random bad feng shui." His sneer vanished.
"What?"
"To tell you the truth, it was so minor that I only did the ritual cleansing to make her feel better and show the Paranetters how to do it for themselves in the future." I shrugged. "Sorry about your wrath there, Darth Wannabe." He recovered his composure in seconds.
"Apologies will do you no good, wizard. Now!"
He and his posse all raised their various accoutrements, sneering malevolently.
"Defend yourself!"
"Okay," I said, and pulled my .44 out of my pocket. Darth Wannabe and his posse lost their sneers.
What?
Said one of the girls, who had a nose ring that I was pretty sure was a clip-on. "What are you doing?" "I'm a-fixin' to defend myself," I drawled, Texas style. I held the gun negligently, pointing down and to one side and not right at them. I didn't want to hurt anybody. Look, kids, you really need to work on your image. Darth opened his mouth. It just hung that way for a minute. I mean, the van's a bit overdone. But hell, I can't throw stones. My VW Bug has a big 53 inside a circle spray-painted on the hood. You're sort of slipping elsewhere, though. I nodded at one of the girls, a brunette holding a wand with a crystal on the tip. Honey, I like the Harry Potter movies, too, but that doesn't mean I ran out and got a dark mark tattooed onto my left forearm like you did. I eyed the other male. And you're wearing a freaking Slytherin scarf. I mean, Christ. How's anyone supposed to take that seriously?
You would dare?
Darth Wannabe began, obviously outraged. One more tip, kids. If you had any real talent, the air would practically have been on fire when you got ready to throw down. But you losers don't have enough magic between you to turn cereal into breakfast.
You would dare?
I can tell because I actually am a wizard. I went to school for this stuff.
You would?
I mean, I know you guys have probably thrown your talents at other people in your weight class, had your little duels, and maybe someone got a nosebleed and someone went home with a migraine and it gave your inner megalomaniac a boner. But this is different. I nodded at one of the other girls who had shaved her head clean. Excuse me, miss, what time is it? She blinked at me.
It's after one.
Thanks. The dim lord tried for his dramatic dialogue again.
You would dare threaten us with mortal weapons?
It's after midnight, I told the idiot. I'm off the clock. That killed his momentum again.
What?
It's my day off, and I've got plans, so let's just skip ahead. Darth floundered wordlessly. He was really out of his element, and he wasn't giving me anything to work with at all. If I waited around for him, this was going to take all night. All right, kid. You want some magic? I pointed my gun at the van. How's about I make your windows disappear? Darth swallowed. Then he lowered his staff, a cheaply carved thing you could pick up at tourist traps in Acapulco, and said,
This is not over. We are your doom, Dresden.
As long as you don't drag it out too much. Good night, children. Darth sneered at me again, pulled the shreds of his dignity about him, and strode to the van. The rest of them followed him like good little Darthlings. The van started up and tore away, throwing gravel spitefully into the blue beetle. Could it sneer at them, the beetle would have done so. Its dents had dents worse than what that van inflicted. I spun the .44 once around my finger and put it back into my pocket. Clint Young Fat. As if I didn't have enough to do without worrying about Darth Wannabe and his groupies. I went inside, greeted my pets in order of seniority. Mister, my oversized cat, first, then Mouse, my undersized ankylosaurus, washed up, and went to bed. The Mickey Mouse alarm clock told me it was 5 a.m. when my apartment's front door opened. The door gets stuck because a ham-handed amateur installed it, and it makes a racket when it's finally forced open. I came out of the bedroom in my underwear, with my blasting rod in one hand and my .44 in the other, ready to do battle with whatever had come a-calling.
"Hi, boss,"
Molly chirped, giving my blasting rod and gun a passing glance, but ignoring my almost nudity. I felt old. My apprentice came in and set 2 Starbucks cups down on the coffee table, along with a bag that would be full of something expensive that Starbucks thought people should eat with coffee. Molly, who was young and tall and blonde and built like a brick supermodel, offered me one of the cups.
You want to wake up now, or would you rather I kept it warm for you?
Molly, I said, trying to be polite. I can't stand the sight of you. Go away. She held up a hand.
I know, Captain Grumpy Pants, your day off and your big date with Lucio.
Yes, I said. I put as much hostility into it as I could. Molly had been overexposed to my menace, had bounced right off her.
I just thought it would be a good time for me to work out some of the kinks on my invisibility potion. You said I'm ready to use the lab alone.
I said unsupervised. That isn't quite the same thing as alone, my glower deepened. Much like having an apprentice puttering around the basement is not quite the same thing as being alone with Anastasia.
You're going horseback riding, Molly said in a reasonable tone of voice. You won't be here, and I'll be gone by the time you get back. And besides, I can make sure Mouse gets a walk or two while you're gone, so you won't have to come rushing back early. Isn't that thoughtful of me?
Mouse's huge gray doggy head came up off the floor, and his tail twitched as she said, "Walk." He looked at me, hopefully.
"Oh, for crying out," I shook my head wearily. "Lock up behind you before you go downstairs."
She turned back to the front door and started pushing.
"You got it, boss."
I staggered back to my bed to get whatever rest I could before my apprentice died in a fit of sleep deprivation-induced psychotic mania. For the first time ever, Mickey Mouse let me down. Granted, being a wizard means that technology and I don't get along very well. Things tend to break down a lot faster in the presence of mortal magic than they would otherwise, but that's mostly electronics. My wind-up Mickey Mouse clock was pure springs and gears, and it had given me years and years of loyal service. It never went off, and when I woke up, Mickey was cheerfully indicating that I had less than half an hour before Anastasia was supposed to arrive. I got up and threw myself into the shower, bringing my razor with me. I was only partway through shaving when the explosion rattled the apartment, hard enough to make a film of water droplets leap up off the shower floor. I stumbled out, wrapped a towel around my waist, seized my blasting rod, just in case what was needed was more explosions, and went running into the living room. The trapdoor leading down to the lab in my sub-basement was open, and pink and blue smoke was roiling up out of it in a thick, noxious plume.
"Hell's bells!" I choked out, coughing. "Molly! Here?"
she called back through her own thick coughing.
"I'm fine! I'm fine!"
I opened a couple of the sunken windows on opposite sides of the room, and the breeze began to thin out the smoke.
"What about my lab?"
"I had it contained when it blew," she responded, more clearly now.
Just let me clean up a bit."
I eyed the trapdoor.
"Molly,"
I said warningly.
"Don't come down," she said, her voice near panic. "I'll have it cleaned up in a second, okay?"
I thought about storming down there with a good hard lecture about the importance of not busting up your mentor's irreplaceable collection of gear, but I took a deep breath instead. If anything had been destroyed, the lecture wouldn't fix it. And I had only 15 minutes to make myself look like a human being and find some way to get rid of the smell of Molly's alchemical misadventure, so I decided to go finish shaving. Am I easygoing or what? No sooner had I gotten bits of paper stuck to the spots on my face where I'd been in a hurry than someone began hammering on the front door. "For crying out loud," I muttered, "it's my day off." I stomped out to the living room and found the smoke mostly gone, if not the smell. Mouse paced along beside me on the way to the door. I unlocked it and wrenched it open, careful only to open it an inch or three, then peered outside. Andy and Kirby crouched on the other side of my door. Both of them were dirty, haggard, and entirely covered with scratches. I could tell because both were also entirely naked. Kirby lowered his arm and stared warily at me. Then he let out a low growling sound, which I realized a second later had been meant to be my name.
"Harry!"
"You've got to be kidding me," I said. "Today?"
"Harry," Andy said, her eyes brimming. "Please, I don't know who else we can turn to."
"Damn it," I snarled. "Damn it, damn it, damn it." I wrenched the door the rest of the way open and muttered my wards down. "Come in. Hurry up before someone sees you." Kirby's nostrils flared as he entered and his face twisted up in revulsion.
"Oh," Andy said as I shut the door, "that smells terrible."
"Tell me about it," I said. "You two look..." Well, I would have used different adjectives for Kirby than for Andy. "A little thrashed. What's up? You two get in a fight with a barbed wire golem or something?"
No, Andy said. "Nothing like that. We've had... Kirby and I have... fleas."
I blinked. Kirby nodded somber agreement and growled something unintelligible. I checked the fireplace, which Molly had lit and which was crackling quietly. My coffee pot hung on a swinging arm near the fire, close enough to stay warm without boiling. I went to the pot and checked. She'd put my cup of expensive Starbucks elixir in there to stay warm. If I'd been preparing to murder her, that single act of compassion would have been reason enough to spare her life. I poured the coffee into the mug Molly had left on the mantel and slugged some of it back. "Okay, okay," I said. "Start from the top. Fleas?"
"I don't know what else to call them," Andy said. When we shift, they're there, in our fur, biting and itching. It was just annoying at first, but now it's just awful.
She shuddered and began running her fingertips over her shoulders and ribs. I can feel